hope can be an incredibly powerful thing. A while back, my mom fell and she broke her hip. It required surgery. It required a hip replacement to repair the injury. And after they did that surgery, we went to visit her in the recovery room. We knew, well, we figured she'd be in hospital for a little while, getting over the surgery. And so we went to visit her a few hours after she came out. While we were visiting, I was surprised when the physiotherapist came in and kicked us all out of the room because they needed to start her rehab. I think we were all a little bit surprised by this. She was obviously still in pain and she'd just been through major surgery. Why did they need to start so soon? Why not just let her rest for a little while longer? While we were outside of the room, I asked one of the doctors about this. What was the logic in starting this so quickly? He handed me one of those post-op leaflets that you get often after surgery. And in there, he pointed out some of the scary statistics about the 5-year mortality rates following hip fractures from maybe just a decade or so prior. He mentioned how even a few years back, a significant percentage of people, more than 70% in some sectors of the population, didn't even survive 5 years after a hip fracture. And how as many as 5% of all deaths were attributed to hip injuries. I was confused. I couldn't understand how, in a world where we'd been doing hip replacements for over 100 years, these numbers added up. How could they have been doing them this long and still, up until so recently, people were dying from them? Was there something we needed to worry about? Was there something wrong with the hips that they were putting in people that were killing them so quickly? We started asking about complications and issues and all of those other things that we needed to be aware of. But the doctor slowed us down and said, no. See, the issue for most people, it wasn't about complications from the fracture or the surgery. Those weren't the things that were leading to so many deaths. He explained that up until pretty recently, they didn't do that kind of rehab. They allowed people the opportunity to rest, and that's what people did. And when this happened, so often, people just gave up. As they lay there feeling helpless, feeling in pain and in struggling with their situation, they began to believe that the situation truly was hopeless. They began to believe that they would never recover or get back to normal. And so they never did. They lost hope that recovery was possible, and as it felt more and more hopeless over time, their body caught up with their mind and failed. This, the doctor explained, is why they now start rehab so soon after surgery. Modern post-operative manuals include a day zero physiotherapy component. They do this not so much because it's important to start the physical rehab, although it is, but they do it so that people understand that recovery is possible, so that they begin right from the very earliest stages to believe and understand that they will get better, that they don't get given permission simply to give up. If they have hope, he said, that recovery is possible, the 5-year recovery rate, it goes way up. And that was a trend that they've been seeing for more than a decade since many hospitals began to implement this process. Hope indeed is a powerful thing. In John chapter 11, some of Jesus' closest friends find themselves in a situation that would have perhaps seemed hopeless, if not for the fact that they knew Jesus. At the end of chapter 10, after the section we looked at last week, there are a few short verses that we kind of skipped over. They describe Jesus leaving from the place where he was, where he'd been kind of under persecution and attack from the religious leaders, going back across the Jordan to the place where John the Baptist had started his ministry. And we're told that there he remained. We're not told exactly how long he was there, but while he was there, he was involved in some seemingly pretty powerful ministry. This was a little way outside of Jerusalem, somewhere along the river on the road to Jericho, and we're told that while he was there, people recognized him as the one who John had been speaking about, and that many believed in him there. It was a fruitful, powerful season of ministry, even as he'd had to withdraw from the city itself. However, as chapter 11 begins, an apparently pressing situation has come up that would seem to drag him away from this place across the river. We're going to be camping out here in chapter 11. We'll be jumping around all through the passage, so if you've got a Bible, do open up there and kind of keep your thumb in that page. We're going to be focusing on various parts of this passage, but we'll start at chapter 1, or at verse 1 rather, to get the context of what's going on here. Chapter 11, verse 1. Now a man was sick, Lazarus from Bethany, the village of Mary and his sister Martha. Mary was the one who anointed the Lord with perfume and wiped his feet with her hair. And it was her brother Lazarus who was sick. So the sister sent a message to him, "Lord, the one who you love is sick." When Jesus heard it, he said, "This sickness will not end in death, but for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it." It begins with a reasonable request. What difference could 2 days really make? Because if we read on in verse 5 and 6, we're told that now that Jesus loved Martha, her sister, and Lazarus. So when he heard that he was sick, he stayed 2 more days in the place where he was. It's an interesting comparison here between their request and Jesus's response. Lazarus is sick and his sisters are understandably concerned. And in these few verses, there are a few things we note. First, we notice that when Mary and Martha send for Jesus, they refer to Lazarus as the one you love. The Gospels perhaps only hint at Jesus' close relationships outside of his immediate family and his disciples. But this language would seem to identify that though Lazarus wasn't a disciple who was chosen to join Jesus on his travelling ministry, he probably had different gifts that didn't make it appropriate for him to be one of those disciples. Nonetheless, Lazarus and his sisters were very close to Jesus. Indeed, that language, the one you love, it implies a relationship every bit as close in its own way to Jesus' relationship with John, the author of this gospel. Throughout the gospel, John consistently refers to himself as the disciple Jesus loved. And here we have him using the same language to describe Lazarus. Well, certainly there are times where Jesus chooses to invest his time and energy in some things that the disciples didn't always understand or get. Sometimes he goes off to do things that catch them off guard because they assume he'll do something else. He does usually seem to make time for those who are closest to him. In fact, very often he abandons ministry to spend time with them, to spend time investing in his relationship with those 12. He withdraws and pulls them to one side to minister one-on-one to them. And so clearly Mary and Martha assume that will be the case here too. They know Jesus is only a short way away from them. Perhaps it's about 18 miles between where Jesus was and Bethany, where they were. It's less than a half day's journey, even by foot. And if they'd sent a messenger to him, it's reasonable to assume that perhaps there was a rider, there was a horse or something that could have got them there even quicker. And so clearly, they assume Jesus is going to drop what he's doing to come to them, as we've already read. Now, Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard he was sick, he stayed 2 more days at the place where he was. Think about that just for a second. Jesus knows that Lazarus is sick right now. In fact, he knows it's serious enough that his sisters have called for Jesus to come to minister to them. This isn't something we see happening particularly often, so it's reasonable to assume that this was a big deal. This was a problem that they felt only he could attend to. Jesus also knows, as do those people closest to it, Lazarus, that Jesus has absolute power and authority to heal him. Jesus could, even where he stands, just speak a word, and Lazarus would be healed. And Jesus loves Mary and Martha. That's the first thing that we're told in verse 5. When you bring all of these things together, Jesus' response doesn't seem to make sense. Does he rush back immediately? Does he offer up a prayer to his Father in heaven to heal Lazarus, or at least stay the course of the injury, an illness, until he was ready to get there? Nope. He just tools around in Galilee on the other side of the Jordan for a couple of extra days. He could have been with them the same day if he'd have wanted to. But he goes out of his way to stay here, 18 miles or so away from them. What's even more crazy is we don't even get the sense that Jesus had some other important work to finish here. Perhaps if something like this had happened, we would expect to see, but Jesus remained where he was and did something. But he doesn't. It seems he just chooses to hang out there. It almost feels as though he goes out of his way to remove the hope that they had. And we're told that he does this because he loved them. When I first realised this, when I first noticed that the fact he loved them was the driving factor in him staying there for 2 extra days, it kind of rocked me. I just couldn't make sense of it at all. But Tim Olson, he's a one-time church planter and now leader of the Midtown Fellowship in Columbia, South Carolina, he puts it this way. Because he loved them, he let them go through it. Because he loves them, he doesn't heal right away. Because he loves them, he lets them hurt and suffer. Because he loves them, he lets them mourn and grieve. Jesus, the perfect embodiment of love, sits back while his friends go through illness and pain and anguish while they suffer and hurt. It doesn't explain it. It doesn't explain how Jesus' love and his decision to allow this fit together. Sometimes we wish we had the answers to those situations. We wish we knew why Jesus allows us to go through some of the things that he does. And we're not told the why, beyond that he loves us. A bit further on, we read that in fact, after boldly proclaiming his sickness will not end in death, Jesus actually specifically waits for Lazarus to die before going to them. After he says that our brother Lazarus is asleep, and his disciples, perhaps rightly, perhaps reasonably assume that is just his body resting so he can recover, Jesus chooses to clarify verse 13. Jesus, however, was speaking about his death, but they thought he was speaking about natural sleep. So Jesus then told them plainly, Lazarus has died. I'm glad for you that I wasn't there, so that you may believe. But let's go to him. Mary and Martha had hope, a very reasonable hope, that Jesus could heal Lazarus. They'd heard about all of his other healings. Jesus spent some time in that region, had probably seen firsthand Jesus healing other people. They had every reason to believe that he could, and no reason to believe that he wouldn't heal Lazarus. And yet Jesus goes out of his way to force them to question that belief, that faith, that hope that they had. We're told actually that he delays specifically to ensure that Lazarus was not only dead, but undoubtedly, undeniably dead, so that he may be glorified. That's chapter 11, verse 4. We're told that he delays for the sake of his disciples, as we just read there in verse 15, to reinforce their own confidence in him, especially in the light of what he knew was coming next, his own crucifixion, death, and resurrection. He delayed, I'm sure, to make a prophetic point about his own divinity, something that he'll do as he goes to minister to them, and something that we'll see in these following passages. He uses Lazarus as a kind of object lesson to teach them both about his own power over death and also his identity as the divine Messiah. But even more than all of these things, the first thing John wants us to notice here is that he does it because he loves them. If you've read that story before and never noticed that part, please do let it sink in. The motivation for Jesus waiting is love. This thing, the pain, the suffering, the death, even amongst his friends, those people who Jesus loves, he allows it for a reason, and that reason is love. He encounters a family of faith, and because he loves them, he stretches that faith. Mary and Martha both respond to Jesus the same way when he finally arrives, 4 days later, or 4 days after Lazarus has already been in the tomb. Apparently, even after waiting that first 2 days across the Jordan, Jesus still decides to take the scenic route before he gets to them. In verses 21 and 32, we read both of the sisters' responses, Martha first, then Mary. And both of them say it exactly the same way. Lord, if you had been there, my brother wouldn't have died. Let's read that in verse 21. Then Martha said to Jesus, Lord, if you had been there, my brother wouldn't have died. Yet I know that whatever you ask from God, he will give you. Your brother will rise again, Jesus told her. And Martha said to him, I know that he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day. Both of them have faith, they have hope, that had he got there sooner, Lazarus could have been saved. Paul D. Adams, he points this out by saying the following. When they say, if you had been here, while their faith is commendable, their response also implies that they view physical death as the end. Not just the end of life, but also the end of hope. Death for them is final. It is irreversible. They believe in Jesus and his power, but only to a point, only in this life. When Jesus says to Martha in verse 23, your brother will rise again, her response is interesting. I know that he'll rise again in the resurrection at the last day. They had faith. They knew what God would do in eternity. But their hope that Jesus could do something to help them in this life, that was gone. And the reason for that, I think, is because their hope was in the wrong thing. And because Jesus loved them, he had to change that. Their hope coming into this was based on what Jesus could do for them. Their hope was about Jesus' ability to intervene, to help them out. It's that view of God that says that he's kind of this cosmic divine vending machine, that if we work the system right, he is obligated in some ways to bless us and to intervene on our behalf. But because Jesus loved them, he needed to change where they placed their hope, not in what he could do, but in who he was. So Jesus allows them to feel hopeless. He allows them to feel hopeless so that they could find the true source of hope. Right there in this place of pain, Jesus reframes everything that they've assumed about this situation, about life and death, about even who he is. I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me, even though he dies, will live. Everyone who lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this? When Jesus says this sickness will not end in death, earlier in the passage, he's not mistaken, he's not confused, he's not lying. He's making a point. Because of who he is, the physical death that we experience, it's not the end for those who believe. It's just the beginning of the eternal life that God has in store for us. And they do believe that. Like Mary, Martha, all those gathered do seem to believe that Jesus, or that God will raise them all up on the final day. But he allows them to go through this so that they can understand that it is him, Jesus himself, who holds the keys to life and death and resurrection. He is the self-same God who will raise people up on the last day. And so to prove it, to demonstrate that he really does have that power, Jesus does the impossible. He does what only God can do. He raises Lazarus from the dead. After he said this, he shouted with a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out!" And the dead man came out, bound hand and foot, with linen strips, with his face wrapped in a cloth. Jesus said to them, "Unwrap him and let him go." I know that sometimes things feel hopeless. At least they do to me sometimes. Don't know everything that's going on in everyone's life here right now, good or bad. My hope, my prayer, of course, is that it's good. But I know all too well through painful experience, we've all been in those hard places in the past. And I know that even if we're in the best of times right now, it's perhaps only a matter of time before we'll find ourselves in a difficult, painful situation once more. Pain, hurt, suffering, trials, challenges, disappointment, they are part of the shared human experience for all of us. They're things that even Jesus felt. We see it in this passage. Jesus meets Mary and he's moved, verse 33. When Jesus saw her, that is Mary, crying, and the Jews who had come with her crying, he was deeply moved in his spirit and troubled. "Where have you put him?" he asked. "Lord," they told him, "come and see." Jesus wept. So the Jews said, "See how he loved him." Even though he knew that Lazarus had to die for the glory of God, even though he knew that it must happen, that because he loved them, he needed to allow them to go through this in order to place their faith and hope, not merely in what Jesus could do for them, but in who he is. Even though he knew all of this was happening to give them an even greater hope, even though he knew he was about to raise Lazarus from the dead, even so, In this moment, he shares their grief and their pain and their suffering. Even so, he weeps with them. And he weeps with us too. We know God can, and indeed does, many times in our life intervene in our trials and our difficulties and our hard times. He can and does heal and protect and rescue and save. And sometimes that can make it even harder when he doesn't. We know that he can, and yet we also know that there are times where, for whatever reason, he doesn't seem to do it, at least not in the way we would expect him to. And that perhaps makes the fact that he can even harder for us to wrap our heads around. But what Jesus wants us to know here, what John wants to highlight here, is simple. Even in our sorrows, he doesn't leave us. He doesn't abandon us. He feels for us, he cares for us, and he weeps with us. I don't always know why God allows us to go through these things. In fact, I suspect I probably understand, or I probably fail to understand more often than I actually do get it. But what I do know is this. Indeed, if this passage teaches us anything, it's this. Each and every one of those times, those moments, those experiences are for his glory. Each and every moment of our pain and our suffering, it is used by God for his glory in service of his plans and purposes, good plans and purposes, because he loves us. In the midst of our hopelessness, he becomes our hope. Jesus is the resurrection and the life. In fact, this is another one of those I am phrases of Jesus. He doesn't just say that he is merely bringing resurrection and life. He doesn't say that he is a minister of resurrection and life on behalf of the Father. Jesus says, I am the resurrection. I am the life. Those things that you believe God can do, know that I can do them because I am he. Jesus is, he says here, the very source of life itself. Jesus is the resurrection for a dying creation. He is life and hope for a world in desperate need of it. Suffering and death is not the end of our story, because it's not the end of Christ's story. That's what he's about to unpack. This is, in fact, the last sign, the last wonder, the last major miracle he does before we enter into that passion season where we look forward to him ultimately going to the cross. Jesus, therefore, poses a question to Martha, and really it's also the question each of us have to answer for ourselves. Do you believe this? Martha's belief, or perhaps lack thereof, if she'd have responded differently, doesn't actually change the reality about who Jesus is. When Jesus says, I am the resurrection and the life, that's true, whether she embraces it or not. Her belief doesn't change Jesus' divinity, or that he is the one who has power over life and death. This truth remains, whether she and whether we accept it or not. But Martha's belief does change her reality, her perspective, her hope, her future. Yes, Lord, she told him, I believe you are the Messiah, the Son of God, who comes into the world. In that moment, Martha gets it. She understands Jesus not only as one who is sent by God, but one who is God. She goes from having hope merely in what Jesus can do here and now in this life, to placing hope in who he is, her hope for eternal life. In the most hopeless of circumstances, there, hope was truly found. Hope is, indeed, a powerful thing. But it matters that we place our hope in the right thing. All the hope in the world that things can and will get better doesn't actually change very much if what our hope is only for this life. All of the positive thoughts don't really change very much if it's only for the here and the now. But because he loves us, even in the midst of our most hopeless of situations, and indeed, sin, in an ultimate sense, is the most hopeless of situations. It is a situation that none of us can help ourselves out of. It is a situation where nothing will overcome it except for Jesus. In that situation, and so many others beside, Jesus brings an even deeper kind of hope. I am the resurrection and the life. Do you believe this? It's a question Martha had to answer. It's a question Mary had to answer. It's a question that all of those who were onlooking had to answer. And it's a question that Jesus answered for himself. He gave them every reason to believe, as he gives us every reason to believe. But the question remains, do you believe it? We can each of us have to answer that for ourselves. I hope your answer is yes. I hope you, like Mary, like Martha, like Lazarus, like all of those watching, are able to place your hope in Jesus, not only for what he can do for us here and now, but because he gives us that eternal hope.